Global International Editor of Art Review, is here with us to moderate the talk, and I'll let him introduce the speakers, and we'll open up the floor for Q&A at the end of the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for coming. So we're going to talk about countries and buildings, and countries in buildings, and how you fit countries into small buildings. Small buildings in parks, in Venice, mainly. Because Venice Biennale is the only Biennale that still uses the National Pavilion model. I think we're going to have to talk about how that came about and why that came about. The Sao Paulo Biennale, by Emma de Sao Paulo, it's copied this model until 2004 and then it jettisoned it. So if anything, Venice is this maybe it's a dinosaur, maybe it isn't. Maybe we can, maybe it can be radicalized. Maybe there's ways to save this or do something with this model. But we've got two much more experienced and researched and intellects with us who have not only thought about this but have been in the lion's mouth, as it were, in the golden lion's mouth, as it were, and curated national pavilions in both. So we have Sebastian Cicocci, who co-curated with Galit Eilat the Polish Pavilion for the 54th edition of Venice, which was in 2011. You'll tell us more about that, but that was the first Polish Pavilion to not feature a Polish artist or be represented by a non-Polish national. And then we have Bartolomeo Pietro Marchi, who curated the Italian Pavilion, which is not your usual pavilion, I suppose. It's the gregarious older brother of national pavilions, and that was in 2013. So maybe we can start, and I think you've got some pictures to show and to talk maybe about the history and how this came about. Thank you.
Yes. Always very nice to talk about the Venice Biennale, because in fact it's one of the, I think, the former, the oldest Biennale in the world, and it was established in 1895, so it has been more than 100 years now, and it was thought, it was started as on the model of the Universal Exhibition. So you know that Universal Exhibition was done from different countries, like in Paris or in the different cities around the world. And that was in Venice, and since that at the end of the Exposition Universelle, they thought to turn the Giardini, where the Universal Exhibition was held, into a permanent dedicated space for art, for contemporary art at the time. And so that was an idea of the mayor of Venice at the beginning, and that's why it started like this. And the first pavilion were started to build it in early 20th century. 1903 was the Belgian Pavilion, one of the first, the very first one. And little by little, with very famous architects, some of them also, like Ritter, for the Deutsche Pavilion. And so this was the model, and it works for several years till the end of the 60s, when they started to put in some of criticizing this model. Of course, of this idea of representing a nation was related also with a sort of a colonial thought and colonial culture that came from So in 1968, of course, together with the Biennale, the International Biennale, they started the first criticism against the model. But it's still in game because for a long time, yeah. But this goes together very related with the story of the Italian pavilion, which is I'll show you just a photo and then we will turn. This was the Italian pavilion in the middle of the Giardini, which was dedicated only to Italian art till the 80s, to the late 80s. And of course, some of the edition international artists were invited in the Italian pavilion, but for a long time it was only dedicated to Italian art. So the Italian pavilion was the main exhibition hall where now the international part of the international exhibition is. So in fact, some years ago, they took out the Italia from the front and they put it La Biennale on the side, and the sign Italia went into the garden of the new Italian.
Was there any protest to that by the Italian public?
Yes, it was. I mean. Because it's very sensible, you know, the discourse and the talks around the Italian pavilion is always very, very sensible because it changed a lot in the years. And this space that now is at the end of the Corderia, no? And when you go out from the Corderia and you continue to walk to the Giardini delle Vergini, which is the really end of the whole itinerary of the Biennale, there is this space, the space of the new Italian pavilion, which is a huge space, quite big, and it's 2,000 square meters, without nothing inside, completely empty, and this garden, the garden which is outside. So, in some way, this was a sort of a shock, because from the real center of the Giardini, with a huge space dedicated to that, for a long time it was disappeared. They said that the Italy didn't need an international pavilion. For 10 years we didn't have any Italian pavilion. And then from 1997 they started to have this space. But we will go through this criticism later, but we can go through another.
Sure. And maybe as we're on the segue into public criticism, was there disquiet in Poland when Jarl Batana was announced as representing Poland? And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that story, because it isn't totally removed from the idea of the Polish state.
Yeah, there are quite a number of interesting issues which might be touched with this case. It wasn't my first time when I won the competition. I did the Polish pavilion 4 years before with Monika Sosnowska, which was, I think now when I'm thinking about removing this name of Italy and this architectural ideological aspect of the whole this artificial environment. Now I read this previous project in a completely different way, you know, because we spent so much time kind of excavating those stories, you know, and thinking about the architecture, because a part of the Monika Sosnowska's installation was an idea to kind of exhibit the pavilion itself. So it was a struggle between two buildings. You had this modernist pavilion skeleton kind of squashed inside, which is definitely too big to be put into such a piece of kind of representative national architecture. So we were trying to think also about this kind of artificial continent, the Polish pavilion is behind the canal, so it's like it's a segment of pavilions which was added in the 30s, in 1932. As far as I remember, it was Brune the what is it? It's the St. Helen Island, yeah, itself. So there's like a very strange thing, and it's quite a laboratory. You can see there's like Greece, Sweden. Sweden withdrew. They gave it to Romania. There was Switzerland. Switzerland managed to build like a proper pavilion in a proper place next to the entrance. So it was even to the city of Venice, and this is like the only city which got like a pavilion, you know. Like, and then you have Egypt. Egypt got it from somebody else who it was from Switzerland. Then you had Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist. So they kept kind of kicking out different nations. It was like Serbia and Montenegro, then it was only Serbia. They had Macedonia for a moment, but they quickly got rid of them. And then you have Polonia, just like you have this name Polonia. Yeah, and Polonia is not Poland. Polonia is like something which belongs to this rhetoric, this language of a nationalistic propaganda of the 30s. Polonia is a female heroine which represents this kind of suffering, martyrdom, and some Polonia. Polonia is like a suffering with Polish female. So, and inside you have, and then, you know, like all of a sudden we were neighbors with Romania, which actually was true in 1939, you know, so you have like this. And then Austria popped up, you know, those additional pavilions, Greece and Austria, and in the end, this modernist pavilion of Brazil was added, which was blocking the view to the segment, you know. So this is like, okay, so you're ending up with Brazil, you know, like Austria, Romania, the city of Venice, Egypt, Yugoslavia, which is kind of falling apart, you know, like it's a very strange thing. So a part of this project was to kind of exhibit it, to make it visible. So we removed all the lightning. It was only the skylight, which is interesting. So like in the evenings, it was kind of disappearing, like the whole structure. It's just like a ruin. So I think it was also quite an attempt to touch upon those, like, you know, we were thinking about the 30s. You know, like when it was built for a reason. And this is exactly the year where the Polish president Mosiecki ordered to build a detention camp for communist activists and Ukrainian people. So this is like those demons were kind of really waking up. It was exactly the moment. So the pavilion, I also found this kind of story, but I couldn't really verify it. Like, they wanted desperately to buy a pavilion, the Polish people, to be in this constellation of those like important nations, and they were proposed to buy the German pavilion, which was indebted. They didn't pay money for like 4 years to the city of Venice, and Venice said, okay, so maybe you can like take this one, you know, it's quite big, and it's, you know, and it's already, you know, 1930s,
and
you know,
it's so 1930s.
So, yeah, they kind of, I don't know if it's true, but there's like this anecdote which keeps kind of popping up in different books. So it's a longer story, you know, like what they represent, those buildings, and how they create this weird, like, kind of distorted after image of the real geopolitical kind of connections, relationships, and so on. So with Lea Batana, it was quite kind of easy, because she was dealing with Polish issues. She had been working with so-called the Polish trilogy for a number of years, so she was quite well like recognized. She had like Polish friends, you know. It was like quite a collective effort to produce this pavilion, involving like many like Polish like left-wing politicians, you know, philosophers. It was quite a collective. And to remind you, or to those people who don't know the project, the idea was to establish a movement the Jewish Renaissance movement in Poland. So it's like one of those like pseudo fictional or maybe true movements, you know, which was supposed to have like a kind of propaganda center in Poland, in this pavilion. So of course it was heavily criticized because you cannot. It's quite evident in Yair Batena's work that you are very confused. Those words are very simple, and you don't know like is she like forcing a kind of this kind of like a Zionist propaganda, or is she like anti-Semitic, or is she what is her agenda? Yeah? So of course you know it was like a quite a discussion also in like our circle, you know like. What are you promoting? You know, are you really like? Do you really believe that those like millions of Jews will come to Poland and so on? Even though, you know, we had to like kind of add all those elements as I was writing the manifesto of this movement. You know, we had like you know like ID cards and all those things. So people were like you know signing it. Like I think Boltanski was the first one who entered the pavilion and got like the ID. You know, so it was like okay. But yeah, of course, it was like heavily criticized. But I think it might have been like the last time, the last moment when it was possible. You know, like nowadays it would be. Of course, like it's the question of procedures because we have like we mentioned discussing it before our like public meeting that also the procedures are quite important and they differ a lot. You know, it depends on our country. You know, some of the countries they. Are quite flexible, you know, and they don't care so much, you know. Sometimes you have like different like organizations, like the British Council, or and in Poland it's a quite a democratic procedure. You have a body of experts. They select the project. Curators might apply. The committee doesn't know the name of the curator. It's like you apply anonymously. They know the project. They like the project, they open the envelope for the name of the curator, and that's fair. You know, this is the aspect.
In fact, that's the force of the Venice Biennale, because it's a structure that now is a foundation of the Venice Biennale, so it's autonomous by the Ministry of Culture. So it's an autonomous institution, and it was established as a foundation at the beginning of the 2000s, so it's quite recently, but it works really well because now it's managed by Paolo Baratta, which is a very good manager, and he understood that the structure of the foundation of the Biennale could work very well also in our days because there is a return. Very strong return of the willing to be represented as a nation in the Venice Biennale.
And what do you think? I mean, what does that do? What's the aim of a national movement? I mean, last year there was I don't know if this is a complete list, but Seychelles, Grenada, Mongolia, Mozambique, Mauritius. All the countries beginning with them, they all like kind of joined with they had pavilions for the first time. And these were kind of, you know, for them I'm imagining that this was a moment to say, look, this is Mongolian art. And I would imagine that to the most high percentage of the visitors, that's probably the first time they'd seen any Mongolian art. You know, so what's the aim for a country that's more established? So, I mean, you mentioned the British Council. The British Council explicitly is about spreading British values. I mean, it's in their, you know, it's in their mission statement.
But I think that the force is that the fact that the Venice Biennale is putting a platform. Then every nation could do, because you have just to apply. It's not the Venice Biennale that decides the nation to be invited. You just apply and pay, of course. So, and then you have a committee that if all the things are okay, I mean if there's no illegal things or strange things that's going on your application, because it happened also. Of course it happened. And you have the space also outside, because you know that a lot of national pavilions are in the city, not in the Giardini or in the Corderie. And you apply, you have the space, and you pay, and you have your representation. And the last one, in 2013, I must say I was very surprised, because also the Vatican applied to have his own pavilion. So which is quite strange for us. I mean, it's quite near to the Italian pavilions.
And some of the newer pavilions are incredibly successful. The Iraqi pavilion won the prize, the Golden Lion, for the
Armenian.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting to see those who might not have as much money, and certainly are probably organising it in more chaotic circumstances at home. What do you think a pavilion does for like a home nation's art scene? Is it part of it? Is it productive? Is it something that helps the artists in Poland?
It's quite a vanity game, of course, but the thing is, you know, it depends on the country, because it was like one fantastic tool to kind of analyze, you know, like to x-ray, you know, what it does and what are the motivations. It was like a little, like an iPhone application, like 3 years ago, which was designed by Jana Sta, the Dutch artist. And it was called like the ideological guide to the Venice Biennale. So you are just downloading it. It was super useful as a map, because sometimes those pavilions are quite well hidden, and of course, you know, it's like a GPS thing. But it was showing the political relationships between those countries, the alliances, the like transfer of money. It showed the budget of the pavilion, who is responsible for it. It is like the private money being pumped into it, or it's like some kind of national agenda. So you had all those like foundations, and you had those business people. So there's quite a beautiful tool to think about Venice as a model of something, you know, like really it's, and I was thinking, like, just flying to Italy, but I'm coming back to your first statement. This is quite a dinosaur, of course. It's a dinosaur. It's a very exotic creature, you know, like it's the only one. So the question is, what do you do to a monster? It's a behemoth, you know, do you kill it? You know, like it's the only one. You know that the scientists, they keep viruses in laboratories, you know, like they keep it, you know. I don't know why, but they keep them, they don't get away, you know, like they are like in the jars somewhere, you know, and they keep them safe, you know, like just maybe you can use them in the future. Do you kill the Venice Biennale because it's a nasty creature, it's a costly creature, it kills other animals? You cannot keep it, like it's a small cage. It's not the natural environment for this beast. Yeah, for sure, you know, like every single nail costs a fortune there. You know, it's like you can establish a biennial on the moon and it might be cheaper, you know, but it's the worst city possible, yes. So I was thinking about like one solution, you know, like if you don't want to get rid of this system of, you know, pavilions, it should be like a rotating system. It's a lottery. You draw lots. You can end up in a Giardini, being a small country, being Armenia. Turns out you're just selecting. Okay, this time I have this thing on the top, which is to be called like Great Britain or something. And then you're ending up beyond the Giardini pavilions. And sorry, you have to find money if you want to be there. Or they might be like a system of punishing, like really embarrassing exhibitions. If you do it like 3 times in a row, you're kicked out. But no, joking, but you know, it's a joke. But I'm thinking like not having it, if it's not granted, you know, that you have. I think the foundation, the city of Venice, should buy it back. They should be the owners of the pavilions, of the Giardini ground. As an exhibition space with those pavilions,
And you can go both ways. You can really have this kind of lottery thing. The Spanish man thing, but it's too nasty to me. But I was also thinking about creating like a committee of intellectuals, like thinkers, you know, get politicians out there, and philosophers, writers, and so on. And they might be deciding about like the themes for the pavilions. So have like those. So it would be like the national pavilions. They would be like pavilions of urgency. So you have like the pavilion of the radical feminism, pavilion of Black Lives Matter, pavilion of the extinct species, and so on, global warming, and so on. And then you can apply with projects for those particular things, you know. Like, so it would be like the other way. But I'm quite keen on this idea of like rotating the cycle of things. You are not like chained to this pavilion. The very next year, you might end up somewhere, you know, in Giudecca.
So it has been quite a couple of projects that we're thinking about.
To walk up that main avenue is like, it's kind of, I mean, as a British person, it's kind of like awkward, embarrassing, and like I have total liberal guilt every time I'm walking up there.
Is that a huge area?
Yeah, this huge colonial manor at the top of Great Britain standing there.
In fact, I was thinking of a couple of projects of artists that was related with this kind of idea of representative, and one everybody knows very well was Hans Hacke in the. But the other one I brought, I don't know if you remember this one, which was the Santiago Sierra in the Spanish pavilion, and you had to have the Spanish passport to enter the pavilion, otherwise you could not. And he built this wall, and he put it a wrapping plastic on the name of Spain up there. So this was another example was an artist that I invited 10 years later in my pavilion, which was Sisley Csapa. And Sisley Csapa did a clandestine pavilion. He's Albanian. And this was in 1997, and it doesn't exist the Albanian pavilion, and he decided to do a performance acting as the pavilion, as the Albanian pavilion. So he dressed up as a football player, and he went inside the Giardini without the permission to do the performance inside. So it was totally clandestine, really. And then at the end, he did this, trying to find someone to play the football. So I mean, some tried to make in relation, enter in relation to the father. And since Lake Safa, this was in 1997, and then when I did the Italian pavilion in 2013, I invited him again, because it was, of course, thinking about these things of migration, identity, yeah? And he did this other performance, which he invited a barber to go on the tree which was on the garden of the Italian pavilion, so just in front where the sign Italia was, no? You saw it before the Giardini delle Vergini. And he put a stair, and everybody could go up and cut his hair. So in some way this was another, he's not him, it's a professional barber which was there for 6 months, and this was the performance that he did. And also thinking about, again, a representation which was hidden and was in a sort of a different space. So again, there is a lot of different artists that have talked about, of course, identity representation. But I
still think that it's a different thing, but that what you're talking about, because that what you're proposing as a solution for this monster, if you keep it alive, but he's very alive, eh? Because it's growing year by year. There is growing the nation that wants to be represented in the Venice Biennale.
I mean, thinking of a project like this, which is very sort of beautiful, it's very light on its feet project. It's a project that, it's lo-fi, it's relatively cheap, you just have a barber. it's almost the anti of the spectacle of most pavilions. Like most pavilions, you walk around, your feet are tired, Venice is punishing on your feet. You get your biennial fatigue, but you get any biennial, but Venice is like the apophis of it. So most pavilions go to the idea of competing, so big something, people want media coverage or what have you. So I suppose that I'd like to ask about the idea of spectacle and the pavilion. Does the pavilion system preclude this kind of smaller natural? It's interesting that his first participation wasn't even official. Spectacle thing. Yeah, I was just thinking about your examples now. It just reminded me about something I completely forgotten, which was on the other side of creating this spectacle, but using the Venice Biennale infrastructure. It was an old and unrealized project from early 2000s, which was proposed for the Venice Biennale. It was Pablo Alcántara. He proposed there's a problem with cheap accommodation in Venice, and he wanted to transform the pavilion into a kind of dormitory, into a hostel. But the problem was, instead of having a space for contemplating an artwork in the daylight, he wanted to keep it closed, at night, to keep it closed during the day, to make it more like a private space, which is actually accessible only for the people who are using it, and for parties and something like that. But the problem was, as far as I remember, it was early 2000s, it might have been accessible from both sides. So it would re-regulate the system, the flux of people, which was actually later applied by Daniel Knorr, this Romanian conceptual artist who left the pavilion empty, and this is the eastern border of Germany, and this is just the moment when Romania and Poland and so on, they were joining the European Union. So he left the pavilion empty with some leftovers from the previous show, which was really bad, and he removed the back door, the back entrance. So people were really sneaking inside without paying for a ticket. So he kind of epitomized those phobias, it's a new member of the European Union, they don't protect their border as well, but it was a beautiful, beautiful project, really a heated discussion. It was discussing the Romanian pavilion, why we sent this embarrassing project to this privileged place where everything, it should be a spectacle, as you said. So it's I think there are so many clever players who can really kind of parasite on the behemoth, and make it to spice it up a little, to make us think. So maybe it's good to keep the old monster,
to have someone to kick against. Yeah, no, in fact, the spectacle is also related to the fact that, again, every nation is different, the system, how do they select the curator. Sometimes you have a very, very, very official and disgusting pavilion with a super official unknown artist that brings there some incredible things that you never saw in your life. But because sometimes it happens that things have gone wrong, you know. At the end, the most of the additional pavilion I have now a system that works, and can be selected a very good artist, and that they are super smart on thinking also not to go into just into the spectacle. Of course, there is a very important division between the budgets that you can, that different nation has put on the name, so that makes a big difference.
And I'm probably going to turn to you guys for some questions, so get thinking and remember this is a room of trust and mutual love, so don't be shy. But just to turn something less lovely in as a kind of some final question. In this moment, and this is the thing with Venice and the thing with national pavilions, whatever project anyone does, it is political. I mean, all art's political, whatever, but like having it in a pavilion with a country's name across makes it brilliant. For example, I know for sure that Phyllida Diabalo, who is going to be representing Britain next year, when she does press interviews in Venice, people are going to ask her about Brexit. Newspapers are going to ask her about this is going to happen. Like, and it kind of, you know. So this, what I'd like to ask you is whether you think this moment of rising nationalism internationally, in all kinds of different situations, not just Britain, obviously, but whether you think that'll be a very sort of different experience for the visitors of Venice, in recent memory at least, whether that will play quite strongly on our viewing of these pavilions.
You know, I think it has been always like that, you know, it's always like a distorted image of something which is happening beyond this artificially created system, but of course, you know, like, it depends on this kind of apparatus of like selecting the projects, you know, and those agendas, you know, those motivations, you know, like of course, you know, British Council will be very eager to propose something which is not related to the current political issues, you know, like, and it's quite a neutral choice, you know, so, you know, it's not Jeremy Deller who would hop immediately on all those issues, but I think, you know, like, it's not about, you cannot do a pavilion by yourself, you know, you always have, like, an institution, a government, a ministry behind it, so it's always calibrated somehow, you know, you cannot do it, like, it's not like a rapid reaction thing. I think there are, what is interesting, there are things happening, you know, like, somewhere beyond the biennial system, like Saladox, for example, like this collective from Venice, those squatters. This year they're organizing, it's a beautiful way of also like recycling the Venice Biennial. I don't know, I don't know if you have ever visited them, but they have like a squat in Venice with, which is like the furniture, everything is built from the remnants of the national pavilions, you know, those materials, and and it's like it's a kind of alternative economy. They organize seminars, and this year they are organized during the opening of the biennial. They work with Gregory Cholet, the critic, the theorist, and artist also, who pinned down this theory of dark matter in art. So it's like a dark matter theory. It's like taken from astrophysics, applied to like our art system, and the understanding of our art system, you know, like the stars, the black matter, you know, like you need the black matter for those stars to glow, you know, like all those things. It's a beautiful book. It's a fantastic book. So Gregory Cholet and Saladox, they are organizing black matter games during the opening of the biennial, with quite a number of different like
artisan spaces, the kind of like collectives, organizations. And I can see, for the first time, I can see so many overlaps, that those systems are kind of like, you know, like, it's we are dealing, you know, if you are like a big star, if you're Wolfgang Tillmans, if you're like a squatter in Venice, you deal with the same urgent issues, like political issues. And this is quite a moment to kind of collaborate, to ally, you know. And this is, I think it's very similar to the 60s, you know, like it's when, I think the ideal, I can remember, like, I wasn't born there, but, yet, but I can recall from those, like, looking at those black and white photos, with this fantastic project by David Lamelas, this, when he transformed the pavilion into an information center for receiving news about the war in Vietnam and just distributing, disseminating them with telex, you know, like all those, you know, like tools, just to, you know, disseminate facts. Yeah, so I think it's a beautiful project. It's a really artistically, conceptually, politically. It's, I think we have to simplify also our message somehow. You know, this is the moment. So, any questions? We must have questions. Yes. There you go.
Hello. Good evening. My name is Kim Drasser. I have just a little question. Like, I really love the idea when you walk through in the Biennale of Venice that you have a confrontation with all these different, individual. Just countries which are doing their thing. But that's the big point for me. Like, when I go, for example, to the Documenta, and I see more deeper general thoughts in it, well, this general thing, I have doubts about it. For example, I'm from Belgium, and in Belgium, this story is a very little group who decide. Now, for example, we don't have a very beautiful show, I'm sure. Gerd Brakman, I'm a favorite. But I'm not sure if that is the right artist for a Biennale. I mean, I love Bernina de Brakere. It's beautiful work. And Pomeré d'Oc, beautiful. But it's always, or Michel François, we can go farther with all these stories of Belgium. But the point is for me a little bit, who decides these thoughts? And is there a possibility to change the attitude to make the right decisions? Because, of course, Museum M, it's all the same system. And at the end, I think it's so, you look through it. It's just about money and power. And maybe I'm too wrong with this. But at the end, 7 days in the art world, this book, it has a little bit of this.
Sure. I mean, I think they're always an expression. I mean, I think many exhibitions are expressions of money and power, but I think certainly a biennial, to some extent, always runs that risk. But I would say that the intent of an artist and the curators need to sort of maybe subvert. Did you have to work against, like, bureaucrats and like people with other ideas about what the National Pavilion should be about?
No, I mean, there is a tentative of the foundation of the Biennale to try to give the general theme of the Biennale, the one that there is the international, no, exhibition, that there is the curator who will invite hundreds of artists that he wants. So the tentative is to give this theme also to the National Pavilion. So they're trying to do, to say, the more we can relate to the theme, the most homogeneous thinking of the global thing we will have. But normally it doesn't work. They are very general things, yes, like
did you, when each of you were curating and the artists, you're involved in, that's probably more for the first pavilion, really. Did you, I mean, normally when you probably, you're walking around, if you're like me, you're walking around and you're just thinking of yourself as a human being, but suddenly you have to think of yourself, oh, as a Polish person, as an Italian person, because suddenly your nationality has been, you know, evoked to you. And I'm sure maybe that must be slightly strange to the artists involved as well. Was that something that you found problematic? Did you feel closer to your respective countries as you came out of this experience, or further away?
I mean, they know that they deal with. Italy, the commissioner of the Italian Pavilion is directly the Ministry of Culture.
I wasn't so much about the formal stuff, but the fact that suddenly you're not just curating any show, you're curating a show as this nationality.
It's not forcing you to take some different decisions.
No.
I don't think so. I mean, not in my case.
Did you feel more Polish?
Not really. No. I'm like totally against such anachronism as national state. So they should be dismantled. But this is a completely different story. I think it's also, there's like a very strong tendency to kind of dissolve like the system. You know, like you have, there's quite a number of like foreign curators circulating in the system, which are being appointed as curators of the other pavilions. You have foreign artists participating in group exhibitions, which are not so like they don't happen so often. But some like curators experiment with like those international gangs, you know. And then you have like such things like, you know, those like national pavilion swaps, like France and Germany. So yeah, people play a lot with it, you know. So maybe this nasty monster is also maybe also funny, you know.
Well, I think if we can conclude that national pavilions should stay but nation states should disappear, that seems a good,
just maybe we should transform the Giardini into a kind of mausoleum of national states. You know, like, and this is what the Maltese people do this year. They have like a pavilion which is like dedicated to Malta as a kind of like a totally artificial construction.
The Venice Biennale as a memorial to nation states. Well, I think that's where we should leave it, on this positive, beautiful, radical note. But thank you both for coming and sharing your experiences and your stories and everything. Thank you both.
Thank you.